Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, blessed souls, it's time to grow stronger and want to live longer and nurture each other until the universal redemption and hopefully speed in our days. Blessings and greetings, greetings and blessings, blessed souls. We're alive, continue to stay alive in this most existential moment, as well as being connected to eternal Torah Nitzki, eternal teachings of Torah, Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies. You now tune into Blog Talk Radio, and we humbly assert we're the higher inner frequency. We're known as Soul Class. This is Soul Class number 760, Anusim on the Rise, part 35. Blessings our eternal creator, shalom, peace, and bracha blessing upon the entire human family experience with creator's help. Our next program is taking place right now, December 19, 2021, starting at 6:30 p.m. Holy Land of Israel time, corresponding to 11:30 now, 1. Live from Turtle Island equals AKA equals USA equals Unified Soul Actualization. Program content was originally to be focused on and being in discussion with Ezra Anusim, Israeli Amuta CEO Yafa Bati da Costa, who would have shared her shared her thoughts about what has transpired since we did our last program last May 2nd of 2021. However, Yafa Bati called me about contacted me within the last hour and said she was unable to make it because of an opportune circumstance. So we're going to try to hang out and do the program in the spirit of what Yafa Bati da Costa stands for, as well as the B'nai Anusim. And we hope to share teachings from Lenny Bachaya and read from a book, The Jews of Spain. If you still want to try to reach Yafa Bati, even though she won't be appearing on today's program, you can go to her email at yaffbatya@yahoo.com. That's yaffbatya@yahoo.com. And also she has a wonderful website to update you on her activities and her international organization's efforts. It's http://BNEIANUSIM. BNEIANOUSIM.org/. And you were just listening to all that you do. I appreciate it so much. And you just listened to RJ2 Stronger. That was a song that was inspired by DJ Cohen, Alava Shalom. I did not know of DJ Cohen, but apparently he was an inspiring young man who fighting for his life until he ascended to the next level of life 2 years ago, provided inspiration and cultivation of the strengthening of the human spirit by those who interacted with him. That being said as well, I'd like to dedicate today's program to my dear uncle, Chaim Ben Manya, and also for Refuah Shlema, complete healing, for Yona, that's the music at the end of the show, okay, that's Don's Law, when something go wrong, it will go wrong. For the foolish limit of the healing of Ephraim ben Carmela, Sadek ben Sarah, Yona Shmuela bas Leia, and anyone else who needs a healing of spirit, soul, and body. So, bless those, we're going to start off by sharing some very deep principles from a classic book in the Hebrew writings, was actually paradoxically written originally in Arabic by Rabbeinu Bachya ibn Pakuda, who lived in the 11th and 12th century on the Iberian Peninsula, which we would call today modern-day Spain. And he wrote a classic work called Chavos Levavos, The Duties of the Heart, But within the Chovos Levavos, duties of the heart, there were various sections. And the section that I'd like to share with you today, at least a tiny portion of it, is called Shar HaBitachon, which is called the Gate of Trust. So let's go read a little bit of that, then we'll give a little history background on the Jews of Spain in lieu of interviewing Yafi Batir Costa. What is very important for us to know is that one of the benefits the Torah testifies about is that when we have sole reliance on the Creator, we develop a unique human experience called Menuchas HaNefesh, tranquility of the soul. For a person who is hesitant to place his or her trust completely in the Almighty, consequently is placing his or her trust in another entity other than the Almighty Creator. When a person, he or she, places his or her trust in something other than the Creator, then Creator removes his divine providence from him or her, leaves him or her in the hands of an entity in which he placed his trust. And this is backed up by a prophetic teaching from the prophet Jeremiah in chapter 2, verse 13, "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the spring of living waters, to dig for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns, that do not hold water." And also King David, the sweet singer of Israel, taught us in prophetic, with prophetic spirit in chapter 106, verse 20, "They exchanged their glory for the likeness of an ox eating grass," alluding to the worshipping of the golden cow, the golden calf at Mount Sinai. At the same time, too, the same prophet Jeremiah, who we just learned about, talked about the forsaking the Almighty is the commitment of two evils. The prophet Jeremiah teaches us in chapter 17, verse 7, "Blessed is the man," includes woman, "blessed is the human who relies on the Creator, and the Creator will be his or her support." We also see that in chapter 40, verse 5, again from the sweet singer of Israel, King David, "Fortunate is the man," fortunate is the woman, I'm adding, "who made the Creator his or her support and did not turn to the haughty and those who turn to falsehood." And in Jeremiah, chapter 17, verse 5, "Cursed is the man who relies in man and makes flesh his arm, and his heart turns away from the Creator." So if a person were to rely on his or her strength, his or her schemes, his or her physical strength, and his or her own efforts, these efforts will come to naught ultimately. Ultimately, a person will become weak, and his schemes will fall short of accomplishing his goals. As the verse says in the book of Job, Eov, he traps clever people in their shrewdness. And we have also the testimony of Ecclesiastes, penned by King Solomon, "I returned and saw under the sun that the race does not belong to the swift, nor the war to the mighty, and the wise who do not have bread." Again, King David taught us in chapter 34, verse 11, "Young lions suffer want and are hungry, but those who seek the Creator do not lack any good." And again, too, if a person were just to rely on his or her wealth, eventually get removed from them and left for someone else, whether they actually see the loss of their resources, economically speaking, or on the day of their visitation when they have to go to the next level of life, because we don't take anything with us into the grave, it said, from our own body, and thought to speech and action, hopefully a positive, and our soul, as John Lennon said, think about it. Think. And there's a verse in Job, Eov 27:19, "A rich man lies down with his wealth intact. He opens its eyes and is no longer his." In Proverbs chapter 23, verse 4, "Do not toil to become wealthy, from your own understanding desist." And also in chapter 3, verse 5, in Proverbs, "Before you can set your eyes on it, it is gone." It says in Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 11, "At a young age, wealth will leave a person. In the end, a person will live in disgrace." And so we understand that even if a person is able to enjoy their mass economic bounty, alternatively, there can be a sudden withholding of the wealth by the Almighty. As it says in Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verse 2, "The Creator gives him no power to eat of it," meaning to partake of his or her assets. Instead, what is the the shlichus, the mission of very wealthy people. Great sums of money have been deposited with men and women that a person can guard it until the time that it must be returned to the one who is deserving of it. It says in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 26, and to the sinner, Creator gives the urge to gather and amass wealth to give to one who is good before the Creator. As it says in Job 27, verse 17, a wicked person can prepare and will prepare, and the righteous man or righteous woman will use it, and the innocent will divide the money among themselves. In fact, the money can be the cause of one's misfortune as well as the destruction of one's own soul. As this verse says in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 12, there is a sickening evil that I have seen under the sun, which is hoarded by their owner to his own misfortune. On the other hand, we can start to think about the idea of trusting in the Almighty Creator, which brings a person to serve only Creator, and a person will no longer, after developing a healthy portion of trust in the Almighty, will not need to place hope in another person or expect anything from other people. He won't be subservient to them in order to win their favor and will not feel the need to flatter them. Therefore, a person won't not consent to spend time, or better yet, waste time on those individuals that are not related to the service of the Creator. At the same time, too, paradoxically speaking, when he interacts with them, he will not be afraid of their bad behavior, and he will not be fear of their arguments with him or against him. Rather, he will divest himself from their favors and from the bother of being gracious to them, as well as the obligation to pay them back any good they do to him. If he needs to rebuke them, he will not need to be careful of offending their honor, and if he needs to shame them or rebuking them, not be embarrassed, he will not praise their false ways. But there are many nuances to what I just read in these last two portions, blessed souls. So again, this is for exploration. I'll just read one more paragraph, taken from Rabban Yabachia. And we see from Isaiah, who is known as the Navi Agul, the prophet of redemption, but the Lord God helps me, therefore I was not embarrassed. Therefore I made my face like flint, and know that I would not be ashamed. And it says in Ezekiel chapter 2, verse 6, fear them not, and do not fear their words. The end of the same verse it says, fear not their words, and do not be dismayed by them. As it says in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 8, do not fear them. And later in the same chapter in Jeremiah, do not be dismayed by them. And that's chapter 1, verse 17. And concluding with this section, presenting initially some teachings from Ben Yabachia, blessed souls, do not be dismayed by them, those who are a person's detractors. As it says in Ezekiel chapter 3, verse 9, as a shamir, which is a special creation, it was actually involved in hewing out the stones that will eventually be used for the first temple. As a shamir, and again, that's that strong creation that very small in size was able to chew through rock. Instead, there were no drills back then, in the times of King Solomon, of course, in the modern sense. As the shamir, stronger than flint, I have set your forehead. Do not fear them, and do not be intimidated by them. So hopefully next week when we do a live program with Yaffa Batya, CEO of Ezra Lanusim Yisrael, Israeli, we'll share some of these thoughts and see what she has to say about them. I'm sure she's very much aware of such teachings. Now, but so we're going to turn to a book which I had borrowed. I haven't returned it yet. It's called The Jews of One of My Friends. This is called The Jews of Spain, A History of the Sephardic Experience, by Jane S. Gerber, which was published in 1992. And eventually, I was originally going to write to their publisher to get permission to read from this, but then the corona hit, and things got a little crazy, as we all know. And I hesitated to share on the programs with Yaffa Batya because I wanted to give her time to explain what's going on with her wonderful internationally based organization. But now that since today she's not able to participate, and I texted her briefly before the program, she thought it was a good idea for me to share this material. So here we go. We start off with a prophecy from Obadiah, or Avadia, the prophet, in chapter 1, verse 20. The exile of Jerusalem who are in Sfard will inherit the cities of the Negev. Here we go. And this section is called Volatile Origins. The beginning of Jewish life in Spain are cloaked in myth and legend. According to medieval Sephardic traditions, Jews reached the Iberian Peninsula in biblical times. Thus, the city of Tarshish, toward which Jonah the prophet, Yonah HaNavi, sailed in hopes of evading God's command, was thought to be Tartessus, originally a Phoenician, later Carthaginian seaport on the Mediterranean coast. In fact, the tombstone of Adoniram, King Solomon's general, supposedly was unearthed in Murviedro. As early as the first century of the Common Era, the designation Sfard mentioned in the biblical book of Obadiah, or Avadia, was considered by Jewish teachers to be identical with Hispania, or Spain. One particular folk tradition has lasted virtually to the present day, the legend that some of ancient Jerusalem's aristocratic families, deported first by the Babylonians in 586 before the Common Era, BCE, and then again by the Roman conqueror Titus in 70 CE, the Common Era, resettled on the Spanish shore. These and similar traditions attesting to the Sephardic community's biblical origins were probably a form of self-defense, for most of them emerged when anti-Semitism was intensified from the Christian reconquest of Muslim Spain. So if the Jewish Spanish Jews were proclaiming they could not be charged, or indeed they, as indeed they were, with killing the Christian Messiah, because they were nowhere near Judea or the Holy Land of Israel at the time of the crucifixion. Still, these legends do not entirely violate historic truth. Migration of Jews throughout the Roman diaspora, starting from 200 BC, before the Common Era, to 200 CE Common Era, was so widespread that the ancient Greek geographer Strabo reportedly exclaimed, quote, "This people has already made its way into every city. It is not easy to find any place in the habitable world which has not received this nation and which it has not made its power felt." And that's a quote from Josephus Antiquities, I guess it's volume 14, page 115. And more specifically, it's known that Jewish merchants and travelers followed the expansion of Phoenician and Syrian trading colonies all along the shores of the Mediterranean, certainly including the Iberian Peninsula. Ships that brought their wares from the east also invariably left Jewish settlers in their wake. Somewhat contrary to popular belief, perhaps Jews in the Roman diaspora flourished in some measure because the empire recognized Judaism as a legal religion. It was in imperial Roman interest to permit a combination of religious toleration and measured ethnic cultural self-government to the Jews, since they constituted an important economic and cultural force throughout the empire. Accordingly, Jews were treated as an autonomous self-government people and exempted from the obligation of recognizing the cult of the emperor. But this exemption also had a negative side, since pagan Rome did not understand the exclusive claims on monotheistic faith, and therefore assumed that the Jews were unpatriotic. Unfortunately, a claim that's been made throughout the history of our exile, that when we don't worship the cultural norms or the gods of those who we've been living in exile with, we've been deemed unpatriotic, which is ridiculous. Rome also continued to recognize the Jewish cultural ties to the national homeland in Judea, the Holy Land of Israel, after even the great Jewish revolts there in the first and second centuries. Thus, Jews from throughout the diaspora were permitted to send contributions to their political and cultural institutions in the Holy Land. This gesture had considerable symbolic and practical implications for such a far-flung dispersion, because deference to Judean, Israeli, or Israel religious leadership provided a sense of unity. At the same time, Jews ran their practical affairs on a day-to-day basis at the local level, each community being sovereign, even though they all shared the same organizational patterns, adjusting them to meet local requirements. Congregations were typically autonomous, even in the many cities in the empire that had more than one. Throughout these early centuries, the Jewish population increased rapidly, in no small part as a result of vigorous proselytizing. Ultimately, Jews would constitute 25% of the Roman population in the Eastern Mediterranean and 10% in the empire as a whole. According to some estimates, the total Jewish population at the beginning of the Common Era may have been 8 million. This movement westward began after Titus's destruction of Judea and also spurred on by Rome's brutal suppression of revolt in Judea in 135, otherwise known as the Holy Land. Israel, as Jews fanned out to the further corners of the Mediterranean, Italy, Spain to the north, the African coast to the south, they became settlements that have left us such archaeological traces as ruins of synagogues, the underground burial caverns known as catacombs, and trilingual Hebrew, Latin, Greek tombstone inscriptions. One such tombstone dating from 6th century Merida confirms the proud claims of latter Spanish Jews that they were descending from the founding fathers of the nation of Israel. In the case of Spain, the archaeological record reveals clearly that Jews did not live in isolated individuals or families, but as organized communities, while cohesive and traditional, also received cultural cues from the surrounding environments that they lived in. Such acculturation is indicated, for example, the great number of funeral inscriptions that are written only in Latin. At the same time, Spanish Jews remained connected to classic Judaism and faithful to their ancient beliefs, as shown by the occurrence of traditional Jewish symbols alongside many of these Latin inscriptions. In fact, the Jewish conception of monotheism was spread to others with relative ease during the first centuries of the Common Era, setting up the stage for the successful Christian evangelization to follow. Typically, the proselytes of Judaism were strongly influenced by contact with established Jewish communities, whether missionaries, but not necessarily become full-fledged converts. These so-called God-fearers did adopt some Jewish practices, however, making them receptive to subsequent Christian conversion. As the records of the early church show, it is invariably true that whenever a Christian missionary appeared, he found Jews already established. According to Christian tradition, St. Paul preached in Spain. Well into the Common Era, Judaism remained an expansionist, proselytizing religion with an expansive, or I should say, a significant conversionist bent. Hispania, or Hispania was one of the wealthiest provinces of the empire. Its inhabitants granted citizenship in 212 of the Common Era by the Emperor Caracalla, participated in flourishing commerce. Rich soil and mild climate made the province into Rome's granary, agriculture, and livestock, which were cultivated throughout the peninsula, while Spanish horses were coveted in the Roman circuses for their swiftness and grace. In addition, a significant portion of the country's wealth came from minerals, its gold and silver mines, heavily dependent upon slave labor, provided a steady annual income to Rome. At its height, the empire remained a superb communications network that facilitated the transfer and information interchange among such a widely dispersed people as the Jews. The great Roman highway, the Via Augusta, began in the capital and stretched 13,000 miles to Italy and Gaul to terminate at the port of Cadiz in southwestern Spain. Troops and goods moved easily along the ancillary routes that radiated out to the many towns of the peninsula. The basic unit of administration was the municipality. The historian Pliny, who served as a procurator, in Spain, describes 360 towns in the province, all of them sharing a basically Roman appearance with their temples, arches, aqueducts, and amphitheaters. Even today, remnants of these ancient public works can still be seen, such as the aqueducts in Segovia and Tarragona, the amphitheater in Tarragona, and the bridges of Merida and Salamanca. One measure of the tranquility of the province is that only one Roman legion had to be stationed there to keep Spain within the empire. So long as Rome was tolerant and prosperous, Jewish life flourished. Archaeological remains all along the Spanish coast attest to the density of Jewish settlement in this period. Early church councils indicate that Jews freely mixed among their neighbors and were generally regarded with favor. The works of pagan writers suggest that attitude toward Jews varied according to social class. Some admired Jews for their temperance, wisdom, courage, and justice, while others resented as clannishness because of the Jews' refusal to recognize the pagan gods of those times. However, deterioration of Jewish life in Spain began in the 5th century when the Roman Empire converted to Christianity under the Emperor Constantine. For one thing, the Jewish population declined throughout the Mediterranean region as the empire became increasingly chaotic and lawless. The conditions that had been critical to Spain's prosperity were breaking down. Beginning in the 3rd century, for example, the small freeholds were progressively being absorbed by the great landed estates. The invasions of various German tribes from Western Europe merely accelerated a trend to ruralization as the latifundia of Roman times continued to grow through confiscation, a symptom of the general lawlessness and breakdown in imperial rule. As the cities declined, trade diminished and industrial production was reduced to essential items. Naturally, Jews suffered along with the rest of the population as gold and silver were drained to the east, onerous tolls were introduced, the road system disintegrated, and the overall economy declined. More importantly, of course, a confrontation between the new state religion and Judaism was inevitable. Christianity defined itself as a successor to its old and often said rival sibling in the divine drama. Conversion to Judaism became a capital crime. The competition for converts from among the same pagan population provides part of the background for early Spanish ecclesiastical legislation against the Jews. Even before the empire converted to Christianity, the vexing problem of the status of the Jews was the subject of a historic ecclesiastical council convened in Elvira in the year 306. Participants were especially concerned about the close relationship between the neighboring Christians and Jews. Evidently, the Jewish community was a substantial and influential presence, and some rabbis were held in an alarmingly high esteem by many Christians. In Canaan 49 of the Council of Elvira, the Christian believer is given specific instructions on this issue. And here is what was written there. It seems appropriate to warn farmers not to permit that their fruits which they receive from God as a gift of grace be blessed by the Jews, that our blessing should not appear as worthless and despised. If anyone continues to act in such a manner despite our prohibition, be driven away from the church. The council is even more exclusionary in another decree, Canon 50. If anyone of the priests or believers eats his meal with a Jew, we decide that he does not participate in the communion that he so atones. Precisely because Jews were still an influential force in Spain, the Elvira Council found it necessary to insulate Christian believers from the seductions of Judaism by derogating both its tenets and its leaders. Restrictions were imposed to limit opportunities to social interaction between the two faiths. Christians were specifically warned not to ask rabbis to bless their fields. In short, the work of this council typified an emergent body of legislation designed to isolate Jews from the larger community throughout the empire, while hammering out a doctrine that defined and affirmed the lowly place of Judaism in history. Perhaps surprisingly, the historical separation of Christianity from Judaism, with its profound consequences for Jewish communal life, was a long and complex process. After all, the church had emerged directly out of the synagogue in the first century, and Christianity would never totally disassociate itself from its Jewish origins. On the contrary, Christian apologists agree that the supremacy of their belief over Judaism by making recourse to promise and prediction of the Hebrew scriptures. In a sense, then, early Christians could have said to have defined themselves in terms of the religion they rejected. Consequently, church thinkers could not simply dismiss Judaism out of hand. The most troubling challenge was the enigmatic perseverance of the Jewish people after the advent of the Christian Messiah had made their religion obsolete. A partial solution was to reinterpret selected ancient Hebraic texts. Even though the church had to retain many Jewish elements, unable to abandon or acknowledge their origin. Another tactic was to regard Judaism as perfidia, or perversion of the true faith. Therefore, the appropriation and reinterpretation of the scriptures, a process which began with Paul's career in the first century, was focused on working out an earthly role for Jews to play that would be consistent with the essential Christian message. Church thinkers reinterpreted the scriptures to become proofs of the basic two-edged doctrine, Christian election and Jewish obsolescence. Out of obstinacy and perverseness, the Jews referred to understand the shared scriptures properly, blind to the validations of Christianity there, and proof that their belief had been superseded. But even as the Christians and Jews disagreed about the true meanings of the ancient texts, it was scripture that linked them. How should the bearers of the old tradition be treated so that they would not pose a threat to the fledgling new faith? In other words, what purpose should Jews serve in the new Christian world order? A faithful rationale was devised from the doctrine of Christian supersession. The Jews will be preserved because their veneration of the Old Testament bore witness to the truth of Christianity. At the same time, they would be tolerated only minimally, so that their debased state itself would provide visible proof of their rejection by God. Their misery would also demonstrate what would befall those who did not accept the Christian Messiah. In addition, the maligning of Judaic teachings would serve to enhance the self-esteem of Christians. Finally, the doctrine implied that strenuous efforts should be made so that the saving remnant of the Jewish people would, quote-unquote, see the light, since their conversion was present or was no presage or to accompany the second coming. The paradoxes of such a doctrine that simultaneously advocated tolerance and discrimination, preservation and persecution, conversion and persuasion, would plague the Jews for centuries. Modern scholars have collectively labeled these contradictions as, quote-unquote, the teaching of contempt, end of quote. Its legacy was an enormous edifice built over several centuries that provided much of the material form which the theological anti-Semitism the Western world evolved from. After Constantine's conversion, attacks against Jews were no longer solely verbal, confined to council deliberations and doctrinal disputes. Even though the status of Judaism as a lawful religion was not formally revoked, those in positions of authority in the state now shared the increasingly hostile ecclesiastical attitude. The pen of the bishops began to guide the hand of the emperors, and the currents of anti-Semitism in the early church formed a powerful partnership with the pagan anti-Semitic legacy. Assaults upon the person and property of Jews followed as a matter of course, and their situation became a long decline towards the medieval position, the Jew as pariah and demon. It was not possible, after all, for the simple folk and low clergy to discern the doctrinal nuance between preserving the Jews and humiliating them, all the while praying for their conversion, although asserting their conversion would not be forced. For the man in the street, derogation and persecution frequently won out over theological subtlety. Now, in 1409, Spain was overrun by three Germanic tribes, the Sieve, Vandals, and the Alani, who all, but especially the Vandals, ravaged the countryside. A few years later, yet a fourth tribe, the Visigoths, drove out the Vandals and established themselves in Spain, in a process destroying many of the Roman institutions on such ideological grounds, as, for example, the contention that public baths encouraged softness and effeminacy. The Visigoths constituted an ethically and religiously alien element in their known domain. A small group of German-speaking warriors and herdsmen never exceeded 200,000. They practiced Arianism, a form of Christianity that did not recognize the Trinity. Yet they ruled over something like 8 million Latin-speaking Trinitarian Catholics, most of them farmers. In certain circumstances, it was useful to tolerate Jews who could either mediate between the foreign elite and the indigenous majority to serve as a convenient ally when the occasion arose. The several centuries of Jewish life under Visigothic rule among the most obscure in all of Jewish history. We do not know that when the Germans arrived, they found a Jewish population that was well integrated and, in fact, formed an influential part of society. Initially, Jewish life did not undergo drastic changes as a part of the invasion. The patterns of Jewish autonomy established in Roman times continued to be respected. Local communities were led by elders, sometimes including women. The synagogues supported schools. The community was allowed to its own property. And Jewish legal traditions were so well established that local Jewish courts were able to adjudicate, in most instances. The community leadership played a strong role in regulating all aspects of Jewish life, daily life. It was empowered by tradition to supervise such economic activities, such as controlling prices, regulating wages, and regulating the markets, including the use of weights and measures. In addition, each community had a highly organized network of self-help and welfare institutions, each administered by a special committee. The public kitchen, tamhui, I'm pronouncing it right, a chest for the needy, funds for the orphans, dowries for indigent brides, and resources for the ransoming of Jewish captives. In sum, the community was capable of understanding a variety of strains from external sources and buttressing its members even in extreme adverse conditions. Now, under the Visigoths, the Jews of Spain presented a varied economic profile and worked in a wide range of occupations. Some held ranking posts in the government or the army, others recruited and organized for garrison service, till others continued to hold senatorial rank. Many Jews possessed landed wealth, perhaps using slaves to till the land. We should pause for a moment to discuss the issue of Jewish slaveholding, which would prove to be a recurrent thorn on the side of both ecclesiastical and lay leaders in Visigothic times, not because either authority had any special moral scruples, but because the practice challenged accepted notions of Jewish subservience and also became a prime means of proselytizing to Judaism. Precisely because the institution of slavery among the Jews touched a vital nerve in the Christian-Jewish contest for converts in these early centuries, it had been a subject of lengthy discussion and such controversy. Later in medieval times, Jews were rarely slaveholders, although in the 9th century they did play a role in extensive Muslim slave trade in the pagan Slavic lands. They never became involved, on the other hand, in the slave trade in Africa, which was dominated in the Middle Ages by the Arabs at first and then by the Turks. Either Christian or Muslim objected to slavery in itself, and the landholding of the church worked extensively by slaves throughout the Middle Ages. And Islamic civil bureaucracies and military rules both relied heavily on slaves. Chiefly Jewish slaveholding inspired a voluminous polemical literature because it posed a special kind of religious threat. Under Judaic law, which entailed a solicitude for slaves that was unparalleled to other civilizations, the Jewish slaveholder was subject to certain obligations that made his religion an attractive and available option for a slave. The master was obliged to permit his slaves to rest on the Shabbos. Non-Jews worked in a Jewish home were considered to be part of the household and to be treated with respect and kindness. In many cases, a kind of semi-conversion of slaves occurred in which some Judaic practices were observed. Further, it was a prime duty of Jews to ransom all Jews from servitude. For the holding of Jewish slaves was declared to be illegal in the Talmud in Bava Batra, folio, chapter the 8th page. Therefore, the slave who converted was immediately freed. Such conversions became quite commonplace since the Talmud prohibited Jews from keeping uncircumcised slaves. In fact, the Shulchan Aruch, the medieval legal code, has this to say of slavery. Mercy is the mark of piety, and no man may load his slave with a grievous yoke. No non-Jewish slave may be oppressed. He must receive a portion from every dainty that his master eats. He must not be bullied nor scornfully mistreated, but must be addressed gently and his reply heard with courtesy. Slaves were not only given positions of trust in the household, but also allowed to do business on their own account. Some are included on the list of larger donors to charity or the owners of boats. In Muslim lands, one of the last rites of a dying Jew was freeing of his household servant. Moreover, it was forbidden for a female slave to work in a Jewish household in the absence of another female member, or if a female member of the household objected to her presence. By contrast, the Islamic slaveholder was entitled to engage in sexual relations with his female slaves. Christian authorities became extremely concerned about the practice of Jews owning Christian or pagan slaves. For one thing, it was not uncommon for Christians to offer themselves as collateral for loans. Also, a debtor might default on his loan and become dependent upon or even a slave to a Jew. It was partly for these reasons that in the 6th century, Pope Gregory the Great explicitly expressed his concern to various monarchs of the West that pagan or Christian slaves might convert to Judaism. Now, the Visigothic German invaders set up the political center of their new kingdom as Toledo, but in fact held little dominion outside the city walls. Undisciplined and strife-ridden from the outset, the Visigoths never established a principle of succession and orderly dynastic rule. During the several hundred years of their reign, the country was in a state of almost continual political turmoil, if not anarchy. In contrast to the earlier centuries of stability, the Visigothic era was a time of mounting anti-Jewish legislation. The single institution the German outsiders managed to control was the church. The Visigoth monarchs appointed bishops, structured dioceses, and convened the clerics' council in Toledo and enacted legislation on behalf of the church's quote-unquote welfare. This relationship began in 587 Common Era. King Ricard I converted to Catholicism, and Bishop Leander of Seville reportedly declared, quote, "Now we are one nation." The Visigothic elite would be absorbed into the rest of the nation, but the Jews would be left as the only alien element in Spain. This is the real implication of the conversion of the Visigoths. Although rigorously united at the top, the state remained deeply divided politically and at the grassroots level. The 18 kings who ruled from King Ricard's conversion until the Arab conquest of Spain in 711 represented at least 15 different families. Some of these monarchs were deposed or murdered, and numerous pretenders or usurpers simply took parts of Spain, minting coins in their own name. Perhaps, as someone suggested, the monarchy's desire to win over the clerical party was responsible for the sudden turn towards active persecution of the Jews. We cannot really say with certainty what motivated this change in policy, but one thing is unmistakably clear. The two centuries of Visigothic persecutions during Ricard's conversion comprised one of the darkest periods in Jewish history and ominously portend future Jewish Spanish policies towards the Jews. Almost immediately, the new Catholic king, Ricard, convened the First Council of Toledo in order to win endorsement for his decrees to, quote-unquote, regulate relations between Christians and Jews. This overtly eclectic assembly and its successors would often be led by the ruling monarch rather than by the titular head of the Spanish Church, the Bishop of Seville. Typically, canons enacted by the council were confirmed by the king, thus becoming law of the land, but they also entered the annals of the church. By that route, the anti-Jewish laws of Visigothic Spain had been absorbed into canon law, serving as the legal precedents in other parts of Europe, even though they had been specifically devised to address local conditions to suit the whims of the Spanish royalty. In the language of the constitution issued by Ricard, one aim of the new legislation was to limit Jewish influence on Christians. In other words, the Elvira decree to this effect, promulgated three centuries earlier, had only limited success, for Jews were still integrated in Spanish society. Dismayed by this source of both Christian attrition and resulting Jewish strength, the church joined with King Ricard to bring Jewish slaveholding to an end. The monarch decreed that all slaves held by Jews should be handed over to Christian slaveholders, a measure that not only weakened the minority community, but also guaranteed they could no longer participate in agriculture. In the same exclusionary vein, the death sentence was instituted for any Jew found proselytizing, but conversion to Christian slaves to Judaism was only part of the perceived problem. The clerics and kings engaging the broader issue of Jews exercised any authority on all other Christians, becoming determined to make the Jews' worldly position conform to the lowly status assigned them in Christian doctrine. Thus, they were forbidden to intermarry or hold public office. In 613, King Sisebut issued a radical decree in the Third Toledan Council that called for the forced conversion of all Jews. Any Jew who refused baptism would be given 100 lashes, and if still resistant, would be banished and deprived of all of his or her property. Not only did he affirm the proscription on slaveholding, he also forbade Jews to hire Christian workers. Sisebut confirmed his predecessor's death penalty for Jewish proselytism and required that any Christians who had been converted should either revert or be publicly flogged and enslaved. Some clerics, notably Isidore of Seville, reprimanded the king for this decree, but not on humanitarian grounds, like Pope Gregory the Great, who ruled from 1590 to 604 Common Era, who condemned forced conversions in a famous letter to the bishops of Arles and Marseille in 1591, but also lauded Ricard for the rest of his anti-Jewish legislation. They objected that such conversions could not possibly produce genuine believers. Even so, Sisebut's decree was permitted to stand. The results were devastating. Jewish children were arrested from their parents, who were legally prohibited from fleeing the country. Church and state joined together in supervising the forced conversion. The convert who received the sacraments of the church was not permitted to revert to Judaism. Punishment for lapses were severe. It seems likely that as many as 90,000 Jews were converted under the terms of Seisbot's decree, while uncounted thousands more were able to escape. They began a century of forced conversion and martyrdom. The council followed upon council, issuing anti-Jewish decrees with increasing ferocity. As Grigori widely foresaw, however, forced conversions were often pro forma. Many Jews continued to practice their ancient religion in secret, thus ensuring that crypto-Judaism would be a long-standing problem on Spanish soil. Medieval Spain would learn little from its failures on its Visigothic path, using forced conversion as an instrument of public policy. Clearly, religious coercion would neither assure conformity nor resolve the country's political rifts. Certainly, the population at large drew distinctions, converts were automatically suspect, and Christians became ferreting out crypto-Jewish practices and informing on the practitioners. Such particular designations as baptized Jews and non-baptized Jews entered the national lexicon along with the noted novel racial conception of old and new Christians. The latter would not allow the slightest doubts about their new faith. The wavering or lukewarm converts were threatened with expulsion from Spain by the Eighth Council of Toledo. These 7th century persecutions, which clearly foreshadowed the drastic policies of the Inquisition, seemed indicative of a uniquely Spanish racial interpretation of the question, who is a Jew, in the ancient and medieval worlds. Outbreaks of intolerance were by no means limited to Spain. In the first quarter of the 7th century, when Byzantine and Persian military forces confronted each other in a series of bloody campaigns in Syria and Judea, the Holy Land of Israel, Jews in Judea sided with the Persians. Possibly in reprisal, Byzantine's Emperor Heraclius deemed a forced conversion of his empire's Jews in 1632. In Langobard, Italy, in 1661, persecution also took the form of forced baptism. And some 20 years later, after Seisbot's decree, the Jews of Merovingian France met the same fate as well. Merovingian. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce that word, bless those, but in France, they met the same fate as well. Whether or not these drastic measures related to the larger context of sweeping Muslim victories in the Far East is not clear. But it is significant that in these early centuries, the fate of forced converts was already assuming especially tragic forms in Spain. In this vein, the Visigoths promoted the concept of unity of a unitary Iberian kingdom. They actually combined political with religious unity. The rulers of the Christian kingdom of Asturias, Leon, the north of Spain, would perceive the idea of unity and reconquest throughout the Middle Ages. On the other hand, the Visigothic anti-Jewish laws were repeated with such regularity in the successive Toledan councils that only one suspects that they were implemented sporadically and only temporarily successful. We discern a recurrent cycle. A persecutory king, would be deposed, then the Jews had fled, especially those neighboring Morocco and northern France, would return. Harsh measures would be relaxed for a time, only to be eventually affirmed yet again by a subsequent ruler. These cycles succeeded each other with astonishing frequency as civil wars and royal conspiracies tore Spain apart. In 1680, King Erig gained the throne only after a particularly brutal battle for succession. Typically, he unleashed a fresh spate of anti-Jewish legislation, including 28 laws in the first two months of his reign. At first, the themes were familiar. For example, Jews were given 1 year to have themselves baptized or face the consequences. His predecessor, King Recesuinus, I pronounced the word correctly, the name of this king, had referred to the Jews as a contagious pestilence. Erig not only coined the term the plague of the Jews, but he also began soon advocating the extermination of the Jews, lo aleno. He appealed to the 12th Council of Toledo to rise up to the quote-unquote the leprosy of Jewish corruption. By 1694, the Jews were finally pushed to the edge of revolt, but their plans were thwarted by informers. Infuriated by this failed attempt at insurrection, the Toledan Council now declared all Jews to be slaves, ordered their goods confiscated, and bound their children under the age of 7 over to Christian slave masters to be raised as Catholics. That's a little bit of a taste of what we've gone through, Blessed Souls, which is a tremendous historical background, close to 800, 700 plus years before the Spanish Inquisition, hence the history of the modern B'nai Anusim, which continues to this day, which Yafi Batikasta said on many a presentation, that the influence of the Spanish Inquisition still permeated into South America up until the 19th century, mid-19th century, I believe. So we're going to end off on that, Blessed Souls. There's a lot more to talk about, but hopefully next week we will be joined by Yafi Batikasta. And with that being said, we're going to now segue out of today's program with the hope that there be a thirst for knowledge. The knowledge that not necessarily you're going to learn in college, but there is the water of Torah. There's the water of human knowledge. There's the water of the knowledge that you have a divine image. It'll help you get in scrimmage to hopefully engage in the empowerment of yourself and others. But often, ahava chad, one love, gor lechad, one destiny, kolon of all those, but dark and dark shalom, a pleasant, peaceful way. We're ending off today with Gedalia, folk, rock rabbi, water of life. Let's stay out of the floods of strife, and let's hopefully make it a better day and a better week for each and every one of us. Anyone who is thirsty, go to the water. Prophet Isaiah 55:1. Take care, everyone. Until next week.